a member of the Bar of New York in good standing who will make the argument. He's been admitted pro hoc vice. He will make the argument on behalf of Twin City.
Very well. Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Jennifer Wasson from Potter Anderson and Caroon on behalf of appellants. With me today are my co-counsel Emily Grimm and Miriam Smolin of the Gilbert firm. Ms. Smolin has been admitted pro hoc vice to this court, and she will be presenting the argument on behalf of appellants.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
When I start the time clock, it'll be green, and you'll see the time counting down. When it switches to yellow, you'll be into the time you reserved. You can continue speaking, but that will use up part of your reserve time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. The Nicholas plaintiffs are before you today, this morning, on an appeal of the Superior Court's grant of the insured defendant's motion to dismiss. We ask that the court reverse that decision and deny the motion to dismiss. I'd like to address the following points with you this morning. The Superior Court erred when it made factual findings that the parties to the 2011 settlement agreement, which were the Nicholas plaintiffs and the derivative plaintiffs, but not the defender insurers, intended that that agreement precluded bad faith or other tort claims against the insurers. And the Superior Court was wrong for two reasons. The first is that the plain language of the 2011 settlement agreement allows the Nicholas plaintiffs to bring tort claims against the insurers in this matter, and therefore those claims are not a collateral attack against the 2011 settlement agreement, which was the finding of the lower court. Secondly, even if the language of the 2011 settlement agreement is not unambiguous, the Nicholas plaintiffs have put forward at least a reasonably susceptible interpretation of that language, and under California contract law, which is very generous in these circumstances, in such a situation, extrinsic evidence should be allowed to resolve any dispute over the language. And therefore, the Superior Court erred by granting the motion to dismiss prematurely. I want to talk briefly about the background to the 2011 settlement agreement. The Nicholas plaintiffs, Drs. Samueli and Dr. Nicholas and Mr. Ruley, were among the directors and officers of Broadcom who were named in a derivative action lawsuit. They were insureds under a directors and officers policy and excess policies issued by the insurance companies and for which Broadcom had paid substantial premiums. As the parties in that action looked to resolve the matter, the Nicholas plaintiffs were excluded deliberately by the insurers in those negotiations and then ultimately in the insurance agreement, which was negotiated and agreed to between Broadcom and the insurer. So it was a separate agreement which was negotiated first, which resolved a number of coverage issues, not just the derivative action lawsuit, but also coverage issues related to government investigation and internal investigations. And in the actions leading up to it and the insurance agreements and then following on, the insurers deliberately abandoned the Nicholas plaintiffs, abandoned their responsibilities of adhering to the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, in that they took away the coverage rights that the Nicholas plaintiffs had to address the derivative plaintiff's lawsuit. They gave those coverage rights. They gave the right to approve coverage to Broadcom.
Well, if the original settlement is distinguished from the 2011
right.
settlement, have been crafted the way you contend,
mm-hmm.
Your client contends it should have been crafted, then how would it be different from what was actually agreed to?
Okay, so what was actually agreed to was that they came to a number of financial agreements in the insurance agreement, so that's the original settlement, and the insurers and Broadcom agreed that Broadcom would indemnify the insurers for coverage actions and for mixed claims. So coverage claims and mixed claims, meaning coverage and bad faith. What was specifically excluded, so the insurers got the risk taken away from themselves by Broadcom agreeing to cover any coverage claims, but they specifically assumed the risk for tort or bad faith claims. And so when the when they walked out the door, they were assuming their own risk that a tort or bad faith could be brought. And this occurred in California where they knew, and California law is very strong on this point, that bad faith claims are independent from breach of contract claims. And so they can be brought separately. They don't have to be part of a mixed claim. So at the time the insurance agreement settlement was reached, the insurers stood in a posture where they were exposed to the risk of a bad faith or tort claim, and they didn't have indemnity.
I'm sorry, my question was, your argument is that the court erred, or some court erred, by approving this settlement.
Mm-hmm.
If the settlement were drafted in the way that you contend it should have been drafted to adequately protect your client's rights, how would it be different?
Okay, I'm sorry, I misunderstood, Your Honor. That the original settlement with Broadcom that was then included as part of the partial settlement that settled with the derivative plaintiffs should have included our clients. It should have resolved the issues on the part of our clients, or at a minimum, left sufficient insurance coverage that the insurers could comply with their covenant of fair, good faith and fair dealing to resolve those issues with the derivative plaintiffs in the future. As it was...
So instead of paying out $118 million, they should have set aside some portion of that in some unknown amount to cover potential claims of your clients. Is that the argument?
Or there was $92 million left under the policies that was not used in that original. So either some portion of that or the additional. More importantly, though, during the course of these negotiations, our clients...
But that in effect would have required the insurance companies to basically forego any defense they may have had that there was no coverage at all.
Well, that's part of a negotiated settlement, that each party does give up some portion of it. At that point, though, there were our clients were not excluded from the insurance from insurance coverage. There was not an exclusion that applied to them, possibly to Dr. Samueli, who had pled guilty at that point. But the other two, Dr. Nicholas and Mr. Rooley, were facing charges, but they still had coverage. The exclusion that might have applied in terms of the criminal charges or the fraud charges was one where it was actually a final finding of fraud. So they still had the potential for coverage at that point.
Your clients attacked that settlement with Broadcom in the California federal court, is that correct?
They raised objections. They raised early written objections to the fact that it was not fair to Broadcom or the shareholders because of a number of financial reasons, including the fact that the derivative case was going to continue and there would be significant, substantial costs that continued to need to be paid for by Broadcom, and a number of other reasons. Yes.
Did they raise in the federal court in that settlement approval proceeding the unfairness arguments that are specific to your clients that you just addressed?
They raised the unfairness to them as them as shareholders in the original papers. When it was clear that the criminal charges were being vacated and dismissed entirely, they came to the district court and said, and these are the quotes from the district court transcript and the papers that we've submitted as part of the appellant's record, and said, there have been significant and dramatic circumstances which take away any possibility that we would not be covered under this because now, you know, we're not possibly excluded. And the district court made clear that it was unwilling to delay the approval of the partial settlement for that issue because specifically it ruled
Wait a minute. You're saying that before the California federal court put its stamp of approval on the settlement with Broadcom, your
right.
clients were informed that the criminal charges would not be brought or wouldn't be prosecuted?
It occurred the day, the The day before the hearing, in the approval hearing of the partial settlement, was when Dr. Samueli, the court in the criminal matter for Mr. Rooley, ruled that Dr. Samueli's criminal plea should be vacated. That occurred the day before the hearing. The court indicated at that point that it would be moving to dismiss the charges against our other two clients, but had not done so. It actually did not do so until several days after the hearing. But at the hearing, immediately prior to the hearing and at the hearing, Dr. Samueli's counsel both filed written objections stating that there had been this dramatic turn of events which canceled out any argument that they shouldn't be part of the covered group, and made an oral appeal to the court to delay the settlement, not to undo it or at that point, but to delay it so that the concerns of the entire shareholder body, which now changed because the whole dynamic of whether these individuals would be indemnified by the corporation
had
changed.
Well, you're saying that because that your clients were informed that there would be no criminal prosecution, correct?
They were, at least one of them was told that before the hearing.
All right. At least one of them was told that, and therefore was as a consequence, was similarly situated to the original parties that were settling.
Correct.
With Broadcom. And therefore, the court shouldn't act in haste.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What?
Why shouldn't they?
Because the agreement might be renegotiated to include Dr. Samueli.
Yes. That at that point, there was no basis for entering into an agreement which did not benefit the corporation sufficiently because of the additional costs that would be incurred given the new situation. That was untenable. And they raised that issue directly to the court. And as we've described, the court made clear that the only issue that they were ruling on was the fairness to the corporation and to the shareholders. And so the court did find that the partial settlement was fair and reasonable to them. But our position is that the issue of the insurer's bad faith was never raised, addressed, or even open to discussion in that hearing.
Right, but was the issue of whether the Broadcom settlement was fair to your client plaintiffs?
Right.
Addressed by the California Federal Court.
The papers submitted by the derivative plaintiffs and Broadcom had a section that they entitled "Why is this fair to the non-settling defendants?" which included things like they're getting a credit for the $118 million settlement.
Okay, so an argument was made that the settlement is fair to your clients.
The argument was made that it was fair to them with regard to coverage.
And did your clients respond to that argument before the California Federal Court?
Well, they attempted to respond. They did file earlier papers concerning the unfairness in terms of the entire shareholder body, which would include them. And they responded directly.
Did they argue that as far as they specifically were concerned, the settlement would not be fair?
Dr. Samueli did not make that argument. He made it in a very general way, and it was not until the day of the hearing when he submitted his papers
and made the argument.
And
your other clients did
not. And the other clients submitted papers. They did not appear at the hearing, but their objections went to, again, the general notion that because the general agreement was unfair to the corporation, and that their insurance coverage then requirements caused unfairness to the corporation, because by the terms of the agreement, Broadcom would be adopting the responsibility. And so it was, it was raised in a general manner.
Simple. The argument was that after this settlement, if the litigation went forward, Broadcom, so to speak, was leaving $92 million in insurance on the table.
That's right.
And assuming responsibility for the continuing derivative litigation, and that would be unnecessary in light of the changed circumstances, so the settlement should be revisited.
That's right. That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
And how did the court respond to that?
The court made clear that it was not looking at issues regarding the non-settling defendants. The court was extremely clear that this was just with regard to Broadcom, to the derivative plaintiffs, Broadcom, the corporation, and to the derivative plaintiffs. And the court said that, indeed, it found that it was fair and reasonable for that. And, you know, the quote that we've included in our papers is what you're asking me to do is rule against the settling defendants for the benefit of Mr. Rulli, Dr. Nicholas, and Mr. Samueli. That's what you're asking. You're asking me to rule against the settling defendants, and it isn't fair to them. That's the only ruling I've made thus far, is that it's fair to the corporation as those persons are concerned. That's the only ruling I've made so far. It's fair to them. This is a fairness hearing on the settlement with those people. And so the court quite specifically saw that its task that day was not to deal with the issues raised or as a concern by the non-settling defendants, even though the non-settling defendants did attempt to have that issue raised by the court.
Would you like to save the remainder of your time?
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have a total of 17 minutes, and the light will change to yellow when you have 3 minutes left.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, I would like to address the arguments of Ms. Smolin and also attempt to address some of the questions that the court has raised already. In answer to your question, Justice Jacobs, it's clear that the defendants, at least in their own mind, believe that they did assert objections to the fairness of the settlement as to them. Not just the shareholders.
As to them individually.
Yes, Your Honor.
As litigants, as distinguished from as shareholders of Broadcom.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would direct the court's attention to a petition for writ of mandamus that they filed in the Ninth Circuit when they were asking the district court to relieve them from the schedule that had been imposed to try the criminal case. This is in the appendix at page 192. It's footnote 1 to the writ of mandamus. And the defendants say, also pending before the court, in addition to this writ of mandamus, are the defendants' direct appeals challenging the district court's approval of a fundamentally flawed partial settlement that provided no benefit to Broadcom's shareholders and has compromised the defendant's ability either to defend against or settle the derivative claims. That's their characterization of their appeals from the district court's position. As Ms. Smolin acknowledged, in the joint motion submitted to the trial court for approval of the settlement, there was an entire section captioned, "The settlement is fair to the non-settling defendants." And each of the defendants did file responses to that. Whether the district court took that into account or not is hard to say. It was before the court. It was submitted to the court. The court had indicated that it had read the motion. But even if Ms. Smolin is right, that for some reason you can infer that the court didn't consider it, the court was obligated to consider it. And it's clear under federal jurisprudence about approvals of class action and derivative settlements that the court must consider not only the interests of the corporation and the shareholders, and I concede that that is a significant consideration, but must also consider the fairness of the settlement to all parties and even to non-parties. There was a case that was cited in the joint motion asking the court to approve the case. I believe it was called In Re Erie and Pittsburgh, In Re Pittsburgh Lake Erie Rail Company. And in that case, a non-party, Irving Trust, objected to a class action settlement Irving Trust was a pledgee of stock and attempted to object that the proposed settlement of the class action impacted its rights negatively. And all of the parties to the class action objected to that objection being considered on the ground that Irving Trust didn't have standing since it was not a party to the case. And the Third Circuit ruled that Irving Trust, as a non-party, had a right in a fairness hearing to approve a class action settlement to make objections. And, in fact, the Third Circuit reversed the district court's approval of the class action settlement for failing to take into account the objections of this non-party.
So is it your position that the order approving the settlement at the district court level constituted an adjudication that the settlement was fair to the non-settling defendants individually?
Under the federal rules, it would have that effect, yes. The issue was before the court. It was addressed by the parties. The court made a ruling finding that the settlement was fair and reasonable. And I guess my other point is if for some reason the plaintiffs in this case felt that the court improperly executed that duty, they had a right to appeal to the Ninth Circuit, and they did appeal to the Ninth Circuit, and then they voluntarily abandoned that appeal.
Can you help the court understand why it was fair to them? As I understand it, once the criminal charges were dismissed, there would have been $92 million in insurance still available to these non-settling defendants, but as a result of the settlement, the $92 million was no longer available. Is that correct?
That is not correct. The remaining $92 million was available for claims asserted by the non-settling defendants. Any payments that the insurance companies had to make that would be indemnified by Broadcom. So counsel is characterizing that as Broadcom giving up $92 million. But in fact, the settlement agreement itself provided that the remaining insurance would remain available,
but
albeit
subject
to an indemnification.
Consenting. So as I understand the facts, the $92 million was available. However, if the non-settling defendants, the appellants here, wanted to access the $92 million, since Broadcom would be obligated to indemnify the insurers for paying out the $92 million, Broadcom basically had a veto.
Broadcom and the derivative plaintiffs had a veto.
So how would the appellants here ever get to the $92 million if whoever had to approve it was going to be liable for the $92 million?
Well, first of all, as Ms. Smolin acknowledged in her argument, this settlement was a compromise of competing claims here. And the insurance company had very substantial coverage defenses wholly unrelated to the criminal charges. In fact, the principal ones were not related to the criminal charges. For example, the first defense.
No, we understand.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to focus on why it was fair to the non-settling defendants when it was structured as what appears to be something that was impossible to achieve for the non-settling defendants.
I understand the question. It was fair to the non-settling defendants because they received a judgment credit in the amount of $118 million, the total amount that had been paid by the insurance companies. And a substantial portion of that was for defense costs, was not for a settlement of the claims against the 15 non-settling defendants. So the point of my beginning to discuss available coverage defenses is that the insurance company's position was that these individual defendants, who are the plaintiffs here, were entitled to no coverage. 7 years of financial statements had been restated, which would have supported a rescission claim. There was a prior – I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge.
I just wanted to follow up on Justice Hung's question. I think he outlined very clearly what the concern of the non-settling plaintiffs was in terms of there's the promise of coverage, but it's really a promise with no substance because it creates a veto power in favor of a party who would have every reason not to grant their consent. That's the fairness concern. My question is, was that concern spelled out by anybody to the federal court in connection with the settlement with Broadcom?
In fact, it was addressed by one of the plaintiffs here, and who suggested that the use of that indemnity was an appropriate means of addressing the issue that it purported to address. And it came up in the context of the individual defendants, the non-settling defendants, objected on the grounds that Broadcom was effectively leaving $92 million of insurance on the table and that they didn't have to do that. The issue was that the settling defendants obviously wanted to obtain complete releases. And in order to do that, the plaintiffs in this case argued that Broadcom could have effectuated, that they could have protected the non-settling defendants by giving the same indemnity that was being proposed with respect to them. But the fairness point, though, is that the settlement specifically did provide a substantial benefit to these defendants in the form of a $118 million judgment credit that they wouldn't otherwise have been entitled to, and the settlement agreement provided.
That was the response to the argument that the agreement was not fair.
Yes.
To the non-settling defendants.
Yes.
But my question is, was the argument that it was not fair spelled out as clearly to the federal district court as it was articulated by Justice Holland and articulated in the briefs here before us, by Nicholas et al.?
I guess I would defer to the non-settling defendants' own statement of their position to set forth in the brief to the Ninth Circuit, where they say that they were appealing from that approval for that very reason, that it totally left them with illusory coverage.
Well, let's come to the issues in the Superior Court that we have in this appeal. As I understand it, the argument is that we have a tort claim and we have a good faith claim because we had $92 million in coverage before the settlement, and now the way the settlement was structured, the $92 million is never going to be paid out for us, because if it is paid out, it requires the approval of people that would have to reimburse you for the $92 million. And therefore, that has to be bad faith that was never contemplated by anyone when these policies were issued. Isn't that their argument?
I think that's a fair summary of their argument.
And what they're saying is, that's a whole separate issue. Now, tell us why your argument is it's a collateral attack on the second settlement.
On the 2011 settlement? Because they expressly gave up the right in the second settlement to file any claims that would trigger the indemnity agreement. And they also gave up the right to pursue any claims seeking to invalidate the insurance agreement, which included the indemnity provision, or any portion thereof. And in filing this lawsuit, the plaintiffs alleged that the insurance agreement was illegal, that the insurance companies who participated in it engaged in fraud, but the fact of the matter is that the insurance companies were ordered to perform the insurance agreement after the district court approved it. And again, I hearken back to this point that if the defendants wanted to pursue their objections to that, to the position they're asserting now, they had every right to do so in the Ninth Circuit, and they failed to do so. And the reason it's imperative that they do that here rather than come to Delaware, which has no context whatsoever for the case, is that the settlement agreement itself provided that if the settlement isn't approved, the money gets refunded. The insurance company, everybody goes back to the status quo ante. And what the non-settling defendants have done here is they have accepted the benefits of that agreement, namely the obligation to pay for their defense costs and the granting of $118 million judgment credit. And now they're trying to avoid the consideration the insurance companies got for paying the $118 million when they didn't think there was coverage for any of this.
What was the magnitude of the 2011 settlement?
Two of the non-settling defendants paid approximately $25 million each, and the third gave up a right in a lawsuit seeking to recover that. I'd also like to point out to the court that it was the derivative plaintiffs who all along in this case said they would not negotiate a settlement with these three parties if it was paid for by insurance. They felt that in the derivative complaint it was alleged that each of these defendants had 1 million shares of improperly backdated stock options, and it was the derivative plaintiff's position that they had to pay out of their own pocket. That's another reason why it wouldn't have been covered. As I'm sure the court's familiar, there's a very well-recognized doctrine in insurance law, and particularly in California, that there's no coverage if there's no loss. And compelling somebody to return the profits he or she made on an illegal transaction isn't a loss because they were never entitled to those proceeds in the first place.
Let me just ask you this. You told the court, and I think accurately, that what the plaintiffs expressly gave up in the 2011 settlement was the right to assert claims that would trigger the Broadcom indemnity undertaking, as well as claims that would attack the insurance agreement, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
If that is the universe of claims that could not be brought, what type of claims would fall within the universe of claims that could be brought?
In terms of a bad faith claim?
What kind of claims, if any?
Certainly a claim could be brought for a bad faith tort, which is their position, but it would have to be a tort that didn't involve payment under the policy. And there are a whole host of torts that are part of the duty of good faith and fair dealing that don't depend on payment.
Well, as I understand their argument, they're saying, we don't want any money under the policy. The insurance company has a lot of money in general accounts. We want some of the insurance company's other money, not the policy money, because of what the insurance company did to us in structuring the settlement. Isn't that what they're saying?
I don't know if they're actually saying it that way. I mean, what they're alleging is that in this tort case, the tort is the failure to pay policy proceeds. In other words, they're saying you didn't provide us with money under the policy to settle these cases, so we're suing you. Based on your breach of the duty to pay, we're suing you for bad faith.
So let's assume hypothetically they win. It doesn't mean the money would come from the policy. They would just win a judgment, and the insurance company would find the money.
This isn't in the record, but my understanding would be that if the insurance company ultimately had to pay under the policy, internally it would be accounted for as policy proceeds.
I understand that, but what's really dispositive in this case is the nuanced distinction about whether they want policy money or some other money, at least from their point of view. Isn't that the crux of the argument?
Well, perhaps under the first prong of the settlement agreement, our primary position is that the second prong, and what the Superior Court ruled was it was the second position, the second prong of the 2011 agreement that's at issue here, because the insurance companies are being sued for an agreement that was approved by the bankruptcy court and was ordered to be performed by the bankruptcy court, and the trial court correctly found that is an attack on the order issued by the California court, just as in the Garza case, this court ruled that attempting to attack a bankruptcy court order was an improper collateral attack on the bankruptcy court. So under that prong, it doesn't make any difference what pot the money comes out of. But we think the trial court got the first prong wrong because the indemnity agreement requires Broadcom to indemnify not just breach of contract claims, but a mixed claim, including a claim that seeks nothing more than a declaration of rights and obligations under the policy. And under the bad faith claim they filed here, they must prove they were entitled to coverage.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'd just like this brief opportunity for Twin City to address its own special issue concerning this case. And we join with, and Twin City joins with, all of the arguments.
Well, your position seems to be very simple, and that is that the Twin Cities was the primary insurer, correct?
Twin City was not the primary.
All right, but it was a lower level.
Yes.
You know, somewhere near the bottom of the tower, and it had paid out its coverage prior, before, and unrelated to anything generated this, either the 2010 or the 2011 settlement. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. If the podium wasn't here, I'd show you my empty pockets.
All right, so whether these there are viable claims or not, they're claims that would not in any way generate liability for Twin Cities as distinguished from its co-defendants.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is our position, and I think that if the court understands it, which doesn't surprise me, then unless there are any questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I want to address directly why the bad faith claims that are being brought by the Nicholas plaintiffs do not invalidate or void the insurance agreement, which is the second sentence of that 2011 settlement agreement provision that we're discussing. The bad faith claims that we're bringing fit exactly in the empty space left by the first clause that we will not require, we're not bringing any claims that require Broadcom to indemnify the insurers. When the insurance agreement was completed, the insurers assumed the risk that an independent bad faith claim could be brought. Therefore, at that point in time, without any 2011 settlement agreement, had a bad faith claim been brought, they could not say that such an action invalidated the insurance agreement, considering that they left themselves exposed to that risk. When in 2011 the Nicholas plaintiffs are effectively forced into entering into a settlement in order to mitigate the exposure to potentially hundreds of millions of dollars of liability in the derivative claim, they agree to not cause Broadcom to indemnify because the derivative plaintiffs do not want, they want new money into it. They don't want old money. That would just be circular payment scheme. But they don't agree to give the insurers an extra benefit, a benefit that they did not have before, and in essence indemnify them for these independent bad faith claims, which were left open and they assumed the risk for when they agreed to the insurance agreement. And this is not inconsistent with insurance law in the context of where insurers are not allowed to favor one set of insurers over another. And if I could just give the court an example, in one of the cases that we cite about the standard of good faith in California, the Schwartz versus State Farm and Casualty Company, this case was actually about an excess insurer's obligation of good faith and fair dealing towards all of its insureds. A first set of insureds, a first-in-time set, had come, and they had received the benefits of the entire policy. So the policy was exhausted. When the second set of insureds arrived, and there was some indication that they would come, but there had not been a claim, there was no policy left. The remedy there was a tort action for bad faith, and the court found that the insurer's actions could indeed constitute just the tort, that the insurer had violated its covenant of good faith and fair dealing to all of its insureds. And there's nothing in that opinion that says because the second comer insureds have this tort faith that somehow it impacts negatively the payments to the first set of insureds. And so I'm saying here that there's nothing about our action which invalidates or avoids the insurance agreement. It still stands, and we're not seeking to set it aside or reverse it or have all the money returned under it, which would, I think, invalidate or void that agreement.
I'm just still trying to wrap my arms around the arguments in terms of what the, you know, the two sentences in the 2011 agreement mean. I understand your position to be that if your clients had actually filed an action against the insurers to recover $92 million under the policy,
coverage
that would be foreclosed.
Yes.
Because it would trigger indemnification obligations.
That's correct.
All right. But if they couch the complaint as an action in tort, not to recover under the policy, but to recover $92 million in the form of tort damages, that's not foreclosed. Is that right?
Well, the reason I can't agree 100% with your statement is because this isn't a bringing a tort claim as if it's a coverage claim. There is a right for an independent tort remedy, and therefore the damages here are not coverage damages. They are damages related to the harms caused by the Nicholas plaintiffs.
All right, then let me amend the question. Okay. Let's assume we're talking about a claim for unspecified damages as a consequence of the tort. So it doesn't look like a coverage claim disguised as a tort claim. Would that be permitted, or would that be foreclosed?
As long as the claims being brought go to tortious actions of the insurers that are not coverage actions, but here the harm that was caused by precluding them from coverage, then I think, yes, it would be permitted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.
Please rise.